Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Two teenagers in black trench coats laughed and hooted as they opened fire on classmates in their suburban Denver high school, killing 16 people, including themselves, in the deadliest U.S. school rampage on record at the time. The Columbine Massacre was not the first school shooting, and it certainly has not been the last. But back then, in 1999, a shooting on any scale in any school would shock the nation. Not anymore. Already in 2018, there have been a dozen incidents, one right after another. This hour, we're talking about how the issue has come to be reported by the media, how school administrators are challenged by a seemingly random threat, and how whether arming teachers is a useful response. Joining us now by phone is the author of the 2017 book, News Framing of School Shootings, Journalism and American Social Problems, Michael McCluskey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the role of media in how we perceive these events?
Well, one thing that I approached in my book was that journalism is the way that we talk about our social problems. And so the school shootings themselves became entry point to talk about some of the bigger issues of society that relate to violence in schools and parenting and our criminal system and mental health system, that it's really becomes a microcosm of how we talk about things.
And so how the media reports it affects how we talk about it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It sets the tone for what the acceptable range of discourse is and what ideas are legitimate and really becomes part of the everyday conversation.
Do ordinary people make a distinction between a shooting in a movie theater and another in a school, or does the media play a role in that?
Well, I think it's important that when we think about schools, we're talking about children. We're talking about a legal and moral responsibility that our children are safe in school. So we think about it differently. There's more of a need to protect children. So it becomes a different way for people to look at things, because we all have some responsibility legally or morally that our children are in a safe environment for learning.
Are the number of shootings that are occurring these days, is that affecting us? Is that inuring us? Is the impact lessened because of that?
Oh, absolutely. I think they're not generating nearly as much attention anymore. They've just become part of the background of what goes on in schools. Talk about that at a national level. Now, at a local level, any one of these events becomes a very much a focusing event for the community to try to figure out what's going on, how do we stop it, is there anything that we as citizens can do to improve it? So I think you really have to look at it both from the idea that it's part of a national trend, but it's very much a local issue that's affecting people in a distinct community.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're looking at the issue of school shootings this hour. First, talking to Michael McCluskey. He's the author of the book News Framing of School Shootings, Journalism and American Social Problems. Coming up later in the program, we're going to hear about how school administrators are dealing with the threat of shootings like this. And also, we're going to hear a pros and cons of arming teachers in schools. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I remember, Michael, back in 1999 when Columbine occurred, we did have a national conversation about bullying, about isolation in schools, about cliques, and a whole range of issues came to the fore. Is it a different conversation when it happens at a national level than when it happens at a local level with this proliferation of shootings, as you described?
Well, absolutely. So one thing I did in my study is I looked at national news and also more regional and local news, and there's certainly different patterns in how they talk about issues. So a lot of the focus of what I looked at was the problems that were exposed or talked about in the discourse. And certainly I found in the national publications much more emphasis on it's an issue of guns, gun control, availability of guns. While in the more regional newspapers, the discourse was not quite as much in the direction of guns, and they talked about a lot of issues that didn't get as much attention in the national news, more about role of parents and adults in the community, more about changes needed to the criminal justice system. So there were some distinct patterns that were different depending on whether you're talking about a national level or at a regional or local level.
And, we don't need to look too deeply to see the differences in technology from 1999 to today. Social media, how does that rear up in these conversations?
Well, social media tends to go toward the extremes. That's where we're going to get the range of discourse that maybe we're not getting in the news. News is going to, there is somewhat constriction on the range of issues, but there's much more free rein when it comes to social media. But if we look at the Sandy Hook shooting, was it 2 days after the Sandy Hook shooting? I was doing searches online and found that there were already two or three conspiracy theories out there that the whole Sandy Hook thing was a hoax. This is 2 or 3 days afterward. So that type of discourse wasn't really part of the national news. And suddenly it was, oh, it was actors who were doing this. And did these children actually exist? So it certainly becomes ground for issues that don't necessarily generate in the national news.
What about 9/11 a few years later? Did you look at that issue and how it affected children and how it affected how we looked at schools?
Well, I haven't looked at that specifically, but I've been teaching courses in media and terrorism for about 7 or 8 years now and looked at well, conspiracy theories are definitely part of 9/11, too. Mm-hmm. I was just talking about it in my class yesterday. One thing that I've done that's been really interesting to me is to talk to students about 9/11. And over the course of time, of course, they're much farther away in distance from 9/11. And some of the things that people talk about when they are in high school, you could see that they had this personal relationship to it. But as they get younger, almost all their experiences, even though they were alive at the time, were reflected through parents or teachers or other adults. And that is the thing they remember, how the adults around them responded. It's been really fascinating to see how this very existential threat that still drives a lot of our public policy gets interpreted so much differently depending on your own personal experiences and age at the time.
Well, I mean, if you just take Columbine, kids in high school were not alive when that occurred.
Right.
It's kind of amazing. Given the apparent increase in public multiple shooting incidents and in schools as well, has the media changed its approach over time?
Somewhat. The shootings that I looked at, the earliest one was in 1996, and the last one was Sandy Hook in 2012. Most of the changes or shifts were more driven by context, because there are certain things that are unique about that particular shooting, and so that would pop into play. For instance, mental health issues involving the Sandy Hook shooter were very prominent, and mm-hmm. less so amongst some of the earlier ones. So it was all driven by the particular perpetrator of that. The trends, though, I mean, guns have grown in terms of a problem that needed to be solved. Popular media, especially blaming a cautioning of society, have slightly increased over time. Most of the others have been fairly flat or much driven by particular characteristics of that event.
And, again, given social media and all that implies as far as access to information, how does media coverage affect children over in this day and age, I guess, versus 1999?
Well, it's almost inescapable, isn't it? It's certainly, I think 1999, there were attempts by parents to try to isolate their children or keep the news away from them, but it's very hard to escape it now. Mm-hmm. Most children have, at least most children I know who junior high age or older have cell phones. Mm-hmm. They are on Twitter. They're getting updates. And so the violence of society is not, there's no wall between children and the news quite like it there was 20 years ago.
Yeah. Do some sorts of media do better than others? I don't know how much judgment you bring into it, but when it comes to dishing it up for consumers, that is 24/7 cable versus the nightly network news in the olden days, shows versus radio or newspapers or news websites, is there any way that they're trying to mitigate the damage of the reporting itself?
Well, I do have to say, kind of a blanket statement about the news coverage that I analyzed, that the vast majority of it was very responsible. I didn't find too much that really fit sensational or building upon flimsy facts. So I think in general, they did a good job of talking about the issues and talk about the issues in perspectives where you really got all sides of the story. So overall, I think they've done a very responsible job for the most part. Now, I didn't specifically look at cable television where whatever happens is going to be what they're going to focus on over and over and over again, mm-hmm. without not necessarily trying to go much beyond the surface. I think that might look a little different, but I can't talk about it specifically. That's just my interpretation as a viewer of news out there in the world today.
You know, when something like a Columbine or a Sandy Hook occurs, media come in from all over, not just the country, but all over the world. They'll descend on those places. And, you know, when you mentioned earlier that you thought the more regional news outlets did a better job of dealing with the issues related to the particular incident, what happens when you have, what's the impact of having that national and international piece in the coverage?
Well, someone who worked in journalism and experienced that as a smaller community journalist where it wasn't a school shooting, but it was a issue that drove a lot of national attention. It's like everything gets picked apart, mm-hmm. in your community. There's a tendency to gloss over a lot of the details, to portray the people in not necessarily very coherent fashion. Talk to three people, and now we know what that community thinks and feels. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, certainly from the smaller communities, that people are very sensitive to that, and it does not make for a positive impression. Some of the news coverage that I analyzed looked at some smaller town newspapers, and that was a common theme within the news coverage of the, I guess you can call it the helicopter reporters who come in with the satellite trucks, stick microphones in people's faces, break some of the social and moral codes of the community, the way that people normally act. And it was very offensive to a lot of people. And they certainly did not find it to be a positive experience.
Hmm. Michael McCluskey, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you.
Michael McCluskey is author of the book News Framing of School Shootings, Journalism and American Social Problems. Coming up, we're going to talk about school safety and security tactics. What's working? What isn't? How do you even measure such a thing when we're talking about something as random as a school shooting? So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the uptick in school shootings, already a dozen in 2018 alone, with nearly 300 in the books since 2013. We are now averaging about one per week. We just heard about the role of media in covering the incidents. Now we turn to the responses of school administrators. Joining us by phone is the president of the National School Safety and Security Services. It's a private, for-profit consulting firm based in Cleveland. Kenneth Trump, welcome.
Good to be with you again, Ann.
Where is school safety issues regarding these kinds of shootings we're talking about? Where does that rank on the typical priority list for school administrators?
Well, I think the most school administrators certainly hope and believe that it won't happen there. But in today's world, we really have to train our school administrators on how to lead in high ambiguity and high uncertainty contexts. We don't know what might happen. We know that something could happen. We don't know when. We don't know how. We don't know who in some cases, in many cases, and we don't know where. So it's there's a lot of ambiguity, and we need to work on training them to be prepared, to be flexible, to be fluid, to lead decision processes, not outcomes, and to learn from failures, both in incidents that have happened elsewhere, and in their own failures in terms of different drills and exercises where they see things that didn't work like they thought they would work.
Given the proliferation of the number of shootings, are we as a society, as a country of school administrators, are we getting any better at responding to these things?
Well, I've been in the field for more than 30 years. I literally started right out of high school and then worked in Cleveland City Schools in their safety and security division, a suburban district, and I've trained and consulted with schools and do litigation work on expert witness cases across the country. So I've seen sort of the cyclical nature over 30 years. We tend to go up and down to answer your question. One of the challenges that we have now is that many of the best practices that were established after the 1999 Columbine attack still apply today, and we can talk about those. But the challenge we have today is that we have a whole new generation of not only students, but school administrators, superintendents, principals, board members, school resource officers who were not in their current positions or type of positions at the time of Columbine. So we need to revisit some of those things. We have sort of that emotional push after the Sandy Hook attacks 5 years ago. Do something, do now, do anything, and do it now, as I call it, rather than a more thoughtful and balanced approach. It's going to look at the best practices from prevention to preparedness. And many of the things that are being talked about today, from bulletproof backpacks and teaching kids to attack armed gunmen and arming teachers and all of these things, are sort of lack the evidence-based best practices, that some of the more simple fundamental things with crisis teams, diversifying your emergency plans, having well-trained, highly alert staff, and making sure that you have relationships with kids when they come forward to report plots and someone in with a gun, that really work.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about school shootings, the proliferation, the best practices in responding to them. My guest is Kenneth Trump. He's president of the National School Safety and Security Services. Next segment, we're going to be talking about arming teachers, the pros and the cons of that. So stay with us. For now, Kenneth Trump, what were the best practices that came out of the Columbine tragedy?
Well, there are a number. The first and best line of defense is a well-trained, highly alert staff and student body. And what we've seen post-Sandy Hook 5 years ago is a real move to do something quickly and to skewed focus, first of all, on physical security, hardware and equipment. Fortify the front entranceway, throw up some more cameras. There we've addressed school safety, back to the many legitimate challenges that we have on the education side of the house as well. And that's sort of been it. Create that visible evidence, quote-unquote evidence, that we've done something to calm parents, to get the media off the focus, to show that we did something, when in reality it's what's beyond those fortified entranceways and those cameras, the relationships with kids, number one, making sure the number one way we find out about weapons and plots in school is from a kid who comes forward and will tell a school resource officer, a principal, a teacher, a counselor, the bus driver. So that's one of the major lessons learned from Columbine, is building relationships and getting kids to come forward. Another one is to have prevention intervention services, mental health and student support, where you can intervene and prevent, teach people to in the school setting to recognize early warning signs of a child who's having problems and issues, maybe a victim of bullying, maybe reaching a point where the changes in behavior from things that happen at home could manifest itself in school. And another area is to have balanced security and emergency preparedness planning in place. One of the things today that we know is that many schools, if not most, have school crisis plans, but in many of those cases they're one extreme or the other. They're on a shelf collecting dust and not really being discussed and tested and exercised, or the other extreme where we see some rather questionable high-risk, high-liability propositions like teaching kids to attack the gunman when before that we haven't done simple things. For example, diversifying your lockdowns. Many schools will do lockdown drills, but they'll do them at 9 o'clock or 9:30 in the morning before lunch periods, and then go for 2 or 3 hours having lunch period during a school day when they'll never do a lockdown because it's disruptive. It interrupts the flow of lunches. I mean, we worked with a school in suburban Philadelphia a number of years ago where a kid brought an AK-47 to school, fired a couple of rounds in the hallway, and committed suicide during class time. And one of the lessons that we learned from interviewing kids at the school after that was that they had never been taught what to do during a class change for a lockdown, rather than they'd only been taught what to do if they were already in the class. So you had kids who were running across the other side of the building thinking that they just had to get to the next class like kids normally do, rather than saying get in the clearest immediate room nearby and lock down to be secure. So doing a lockdown when students arrive, doing a fire drill and reversing it to see how long it takes to get kids back in. Some things where you're pushing the envelope but not going over the top, because some of the things we see today actually can cause more harm, create more of a panic and fear, create a increased tension, and are not evidence-based to show that they actually work in terms of some of the extreme drills that people propose doing today.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Our focus today is on school shootings. There have been a bunch already in 2018, 300 or so since 2015 alone. It's about one a week is what United States is averaging in school shootings these days. If you have a question or comment, my guest is Kenneth Trump. He's president of the National School Safety and Security Services. It's a for-profit, private for-profit consulting firm that, around the country talks to districts, as Kenneth Trump is describing, about how to protect themselves. The number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Teachers teach, Kenneth. They aren't necessarily trained to protect against someone armed with a gun. Or are they? I mean, is this an issue that's popping up at the college level where teachers are being trained initially?
Well, I think that we have to look at the different contexts. Now, my career focus has been on pre-K through 12 schools. And one of the points that I make, and one of the reasons I don't step into the college and university arena, is that it is a different context. You're talking at the K-12, pre-K-12 type of level about children. You have age and developmental issues consideration, children with a lot of special needs, and a climate where teachers and administrators are, from a legal end, in loco parentis. They're in place of the parent and responsible. At a college and university setting, you have young adults, and we know that the adult brain still does not fully develop in the executive function to make those critical decisions until the mid-20s, so there may be some questions there. But we certainly know that when we're talking at a middle school, elementary school, or a high school, we're talking about children. And we have to take a balanced approach. And to your question, the same applies with teachers. They are laypersons. If we want to, we strike that balance where we give them some basic training, some fundamentals to focus on, talking about lockdowns, evacuations, thinking on their feet, diversifying their drills a little bit, looking at early warning signs. But we still want to realize that we're dealing with children in a child-oriented setting, and not push the line, push the envelope over and across the line where we're making unrealistic expectations. And from a teacher's end, that's what's particularly concerning with some of the more extreme measures that we've heard people advocate for after Sandy Hook, is that, you know, for if we really believe that we need an armed presence in school, then hire a school resource officer. But even if we want to make sure that we're doing basic fundamental drills, teach some of the fundamentals of thinking on your feet, but let's not try to give teachers a false sense of security that after a one-hour training session, they're going to be able to take down an armed gunman by throwing tennis balls and books at them. So it's striking a balance. It's realizing that educators educate and public safety officials keep people safe. It's teaching our educators how to, our school administrators and crisis teams, how to lead in context of high ambiguity and uncertainty, and to communicate using good risk and crisis communications techniques, which is the focus of my doctoral research on this leadership issue at Johns Hopkins University now, and trying to see how we can strike that balance, recognizing that these are child-oriented settings. We do need to have some fundamental basic best practices in security and emergency planning, but we are not the police officer expecting teachers to be the police officers making a traffic stop in the back alley of their neighborhood at midnight, or to expect them to provide a public safety function, to be, in essence, a teacher and a police officer, while they're also meeting all the rigorous demands of today's instruction.
What are those leadership skills that we're looking for now in administrators when these times of crisis occur?
Well, there's some important things that I think we can do. I mean, one of the things that we know from research is that is that if you look at groups, and I did some research last semester on different groups like Navy SEALs, wildfire fighters, different people in hospitals, leaders, how do they deal with a great deal of ambiguity and uncertainty? And we learned the first thing is that they learn from the failure. So we need to study other prior incidents. We need to study our own incidents, simple things. If we're doing a lockdown or a fire drill or an evacuation, have we done a debriefing to learn what worked so we know to keep it in place? And those failures, where did we run into problems? Basic, simple things. The teacher couldn't lock the door in room 12 because the door is not working. Somebody didn't hear the announcement in a restroom because the PA didn't cover that area or wasn't functioning. So having that that approach of learning from failures. And then another area is leading the decision-making process but not focusing on the outcome. We need our school administrators to train them and their crisis teams to do some simple things, tabletop exercises, where you sit down and take that pretty glossy crisis plan book that you have up on a shelf and you meet with your first responders, your community partners, your school crisis team, and your district crisis team, and take a half a day in a professional development classroom setting and go through a hypothetical scenario as a group to discuss what would work and what wouldn't work under that scenario. For example, if you have the right people at the table, your school secretary or your custodian is going, or your cafeteria manager even, is going to think of different issues than will your principal and your school resource officer, your classroom teacher, in terms of issues that would arise in a hypothetical emergency. And that's where you strengthen your plans, you test them and get them off a shelf, but you don't go over the top by creating some extreme drills where you're giving a false sense of security. And even in some cases, we've seen there's an insurance company out in Iowa that reports spending more than $1 million in workers' comp injuries to school staff just from active shooter training. So we want to strike that balance, and it's really important to meet a happy medium.
And there's another thing that I hear you saying is be inclusive. Everybody has a point of view. Listen to everybody.
Absolutely. One of the things, I've been in this business for 30 years, and when we facilitate tabletop exercises across the country with schools, one of the things that intrigues me so much is we've done our best to include people like your cafeteria workers who handle school breakfasts and lunches. And I've had people who've told me they've worked for 30 years in school systems as a custodian, a school secretary, a cafeteria worker, maybe the school nurse, and they've never been brought to the table to participate in a tabletop exercise, never been to a faculty meeting to be trained on the crisis plan, and never had any professional development or conversation as part of the crisis team. So a lot of this stuff, really, we stress our nuts and bolts practical things. People are looking for the wow, but they're not thinking about the how. And we want to make sure that we take a look and say, what are the simple basic things we could do? And I would rather see a school principal who's very, very busy focus on four or five key points over the course of a year to work on that are basic fundamentals than to try to do some quick fix that gives you more cameras or that oftentimes breaks down and don't work and they don't have the money to repair them, as a side note, or some type of visual that looks like you have a more secure school, but you really don't necessarily meet the fundamentals. The bottom line is that the best security and the best preparedness in many cases is invisible.
And what about that piece of listening to kids, taking in information and acting on it or looking into it, that kind of a thing?
That is so critical because I can harken back to the days when I ran the gang unit in Cleveland City school system and when I worked in the front lines of school security and in the buildings. And kids, if they trust you, if they have a relationship with you, if you're genuinely sincere in what you do as an adult and are interested, they will tell you. I mean, I used to have kids who would walk off the bus in the morning arriving at school and say, "Hey, Mr. Trump, so-and-so's got a gun," and they'd keep walking. And it may sound questionable, but it does work. The number one way we find out, in our school resource officers, for example, many think that they're there to cuff and stuff and arrest kids. Really, they're there as a first line of prevention, and they prevent many things because they build relationships with kids, and kids come forward and tell them of a plot, a plan, something that happened out in the community that will spill over the school, somebody who has a weapon, somebody who's talking about killing themselves, whatever the issue may be. So that relationship is one key tool in that whole continuum from prevention to preparedness.
Now, what about social media? How has that changed this equation for administrators? It's a whole nother level of review.
It is. Social media has brought so many different challenges to school safety. We did a study, it's on our website at schoolsecurity.org, of more than 800 violent school threats, shooting and bomb threats a couple of years ago. And we found that the more than a third, 37%, were actually sent electronically, the bulk of those by social media. And that's presented some really new investigative challenges for school administrators and school police. And we have threats that are coming into schools through what's called swatting that actually originate across state lines and in some cases international borders, not to mention those clues and challenges that pop up on social media about different plots and the bullying and the cyberbullying that goes on. So technology is great. It's provided many positive things to myself and everyone else in today's world. But with that comes some new times, new crimes, new challenges. And we have to factor that in our emergency planning. And one key point from that is that one of the things that we work on training administrators on today is they not only need to have a crisis plan to deal with the investigation and handling of an emergency, but they have to have a crisis communications and social media strategy plan as well, because they're not only managing the incident, they're managing the rumors and misinformation that spreads in seconds and minutes rather than hours and days as it did in years past. And they have to manage that crisis of communications right alongside the crisis of handling the investigation and security of the incident itself versus having one occur after the other. You deal with the emergency and then you deal with the communication. So it's presented a huge challenge to school safety and something that we have to work with administrators on as they develop their emergency plans today.
Kenneth Trump, I want to take the time, if you have it, to turn to a caller now. Courtney in Columbus, you're on the air. You're a substitute teacher. Hi, Courtney.
Hi, Ann. Hi, Kenneth. I've been listening to this conversation, which I really appreciate, and I couldn't help but think about my time on a sub in a number of different districts in Columbus, and we get almost zero training when it comes to what to do when there's an active shooter. And when you're subbing in different districts, each district does it differently. And students spend, I think the stat is 5% of their time with substitutes. So I think this is something probably that'd be worth discussed given how much time students are spending with subs and how little training they actually have.
It's a good point. Thank you, Courtney, for bringing that up. Kenneth Trump?
Well, Courtney makes a great point. I think that that's whole part of the whole process. Simple things of How do you orient your substitutes to where the crisis plan is? Do they get a copy of that? Do they know those basic procedures? Do they know what to do? And it needs to be integrated in it. I mean, Courtney makes a great point. Not only does it vary district to district, but I would even say, to piggyback on what she, her point, that it varies school to school within the same district. Mm-hmm. So taking that time, and that's really the bottom line of what we're challenged with here. Many of the things that we need to do take more time than they do money. And in today's education world, where we're dealing with test scores and new state laws and all the learning theories and all these changes and the many academic and operational and financial challenges, a good school leader has to factor this in as a priority to keep it on the front burner, even when those other demands are kind of nudging and pushing it out. I've had people that have brought us in to do training, and they'll say, how much time do you need? And I said, ideally a day. I know that I'll be lucky to get a half a day. And they said, welcome to the district, you're going to get an hour. and the flip side of that, fortunately, we've seen some real good progressive leaders who've said, we're going to keep this on the front burner. Academics is important. We're going to make this happen, and let's take this time. We want you to come in at a faculty meeting and do a tabletop exercise. They make it happen. So there are those good leaders, and that's the focus of my research in Johns Hopkins is what makes that good leadership? How do they function in high ambiguity and uncertainty in terms of the different contexts around school safety, and how can they employ risk and crisis communications? And it can be done. That's the good news. And it is being done in many places. And I think that, you know, just kind of to wrap all of that this up is that the good news for parents, for listeners, don't get down and depressed and think this is insurmountable. The good news is there are many incidents that are prevented, more so than those that happen. We're getting much better at that over the decades. And the good news is the vast majority of schools will never have an incident. We just want to make sure that people are aware and prepared, but not scared.
Kenneth Trump, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you again, Anna. Thank you.
Kenneth Trump is the president of the National School Safety and Security Services. More on this issue in terms of whether or not to arm teachers coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the uptick in school shootings, already a dozen in 2018 alone, and with nearly 300 on the books since 2013, we're now averaging about one per week. The nonprofit group FASTER, that's short for Faculty Administrator Safety Training and Emergency Response Program, endorses quick reaction by those on site, and that includes arming teachers and administrators. FASTER Program Director Joe Eaton joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us is co-president of the Central Ohio branch of the Brady Campaign, which opposes guns in schools, Rebecca Flowers. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Joe, could you tell us what you mean by your program, how it works, and how guns in the hands of teachers gets involved?
Well, the program is sponsored by a nonprofit educational charity. We've been involved in firearm safety, mainly at the youth ages, for almost 10 years now. The Faster Saves Lives program started shortly after the tragedy at Sandy Hook, when a Central Ohio school superintendent, their parent safety committee, approached them about having armed staff in the school, and they came to us to see how they could get the staff adequately trained and implement a good and safe program. So we started that in 2013, and 5 years later, we've worked with about 1,300 school staff from 225 different school districts. the foundation is dedicated, if they're going to have firearms in the school in any form, whether it's a school resource officer or other armed staff, we want that staff to have the best training that we know of.
How does training to prepare teachers for times of crisis like a live shooter differ from training anybody else to use a gun?
Well, you know, they're in a somewhat unique situation. The rest of the public out in the world and in the business and in your churches and in your daily life, you know, most people are responsible for the safety of themselves or their immediate family if they're with them. In my normal daily business, if violence comes into the building, all I have to do is worry about getting myself out and getting home to my wife and kids. Teachers don't have that option. They don't have the option of turning around and leaving those innocent kids sitting in the classroom, and that puts them in a very different situation.
So how do you differ in training them to handle a gun in terms of that?
Well, you know, the first thing that they have to do is be able to effectively stop the killing, because that's the way that you save lives, is shorten the timeline that the killer has to commit the violence and then shorten the timeline until the medical aid starts. So that is all part of the training program. Firearms have to be a part of it because the schools have already decided before they come and look for the training that they're going to be a part of their safety plan. They need something which can effectively stop the violence if needed as soon as possible. But you know, more importantly than that is the crisis and emergency management. How do I move groups of people from an area of danger to an area of safety? How do I evacuate people out of a building? How do I barricade or set up an ambush in my classroom if that's the safest thing? And then the trauma medical training is a huge part of it because the skills they learn there are so important, not only in a violent event, but also in, you know, severe weather or severe sports injuries, kitchen, lab accidents, stuff like that also.
Rebecca Flowers, the Brady Campaign opposes guns in schools under these kinds of circumstances or for these types of reasons. What do you say to this? I mean, couldn't teachers be trained to respond, and that could be part of a response?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I thought your previous guest actually did a pretty good job of summarizing what I'm hearing from teachers and administrators across Columbus about their concerns. Teachers do not feel that it's part of their job to learn how to take down an armed perpetrator by using a gun themselves. They feel that they're your primary responsibility is to their students and taking care of the emergency in the classroom, as well as any trauma that's happening at the same time. And they have a lot of questions. What's their liability if they are using a gun in a classroom? CBS did a story about Joe's program, the FASTER program, which, by the way, is funded by Buckeye Firearms. And Ohio, the state of Ohio is paying Buckeye Firearms about $250,000 for this program. And in the CBS report, a teacher who was in a reenactment actually took out one of her own innocent bystanding students. And the teachers I've talked to are really concerned about this. They're not going to be trained in a number of hours to handle a weapon in a crisis situation like that. And they're very concerned that they're not being given other opportunities to deal with the situation. You know, we saw a really good example of how you can defuse a situation where you have an armed student with Van Chambers from Columbus Scioto High School. He's a counselor there. And last year, an armed student began shooting in the hallway of the school, and just using what he knew about the student and conflict avoidance and de-escalation, Mr. Chambers was able to bring in the student without any death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really what we want to be focusing on.
What about that, Joe Eaton? I thought about that. Hadn't heard the description, the scenario that Rebecca Flowers just described about in a reenactment, how a teacher didn't mean to, obviously, but took out a potential student. What about that liability issue? Does that come up in conversations with school districts that you approach?
It does, but you know, back to the whole other things that they can do. By the time the schools get to the decision point that they're going to have firearms in their school as part of their safety plan, they've put in all these other overlapping layers of protection already. They have the social media monitoring, and they have the camera systems, and they have everything else that Mr. Trump was talking about. They have the crisis intervention skills, and, you know, the majority of the time, these events can be stopped simply by somebody in authority standing up and confronting the killer. And, you know, that works a large bit of the time, but it doesn't work all the time. And that's why some school districts have decided that they need to have that extra layer of security in there. If they have staff who are going to willingly go stand between these murderers and these innocent kids and give up their lives to buy these kids a few more seconds of their own life, the schools have decided they owe it to the staff that if they're going to go there anyway, to have them show up with any tool or any training that they're comfortable with. It's a decision that each individual school staff makes. And that way they have the ability to go home at the end of the night. You know, the liability.
You know, Ann,
this,
I wonder if Buckeye Firearms, though, is letting these people that they work with, the administrators and teachers, know the statistic that guns and dwellings far and away are more likely to be used in a homicide or a suicide than in self-defense.
Well, I wanted to ask, I mean, Joe Eaton, we're introducing more guns into a school building. What are the ramifications of that?
You know, the guns are just one more layer that they can put in there. When they make the call to 911, they are asking for firearms to come to that building as quickly as possible and stop the violence. What these schools have decided is that, you know, even waiting the 3 minutes and 16 seconds that it took for law enforcement to get to Sandy Hook, in that quick of time, we still lost 20 babies that day. And that is not acceptable to many, many schools out there. As far as the history of it, I mean, we now have several thousand man years of experience just with our program of school staff carrying firearms in the school buildings. And that doesn't include the thousands and tens of thousands of schools that have firearms in there without working with our program.
Do teachers,
it can be done in a safe and effective way.
In your program, when teachers carry guns or however you train them, do they carry them on their bodies at all times or do they have them locked in a desk somewhere?
It is up to the individual district. Each individual district knows what works best for their school,
well,
for their
staff.
What
do you recommend?
We recommend on the person carry. That way they are always in total control of the firearm at all time. Also, that is the most workable way. We've had several schools that have started off with locked boxes. Mm-hmm. But as they get better understanding of the way these events occur, the majority of them have moved away from that and went to having the individual staff carry the firearm.
And this is what the NRA definitely is advocating, armed people everywhere all the time. And as a parent, that terrifies me to think about my children going into a school where their teacher is armed with a loaded gun. They have other students around them. The teacher themselves is an unknown quantity. I think that you're really going to have a hard time selling this to most parents. And I would hope that Buckeye Firearms would be looking at other problems with school violence and securing weapons at home, which is where most students find their weapons to bring to school, rather than create a problem that doesn't exist in order to sell more guns.
Yeah, Joe.
No, we certainly have. I mean, we are one of the charter supporters of the American Association of Pediatrics Store It Safe program here in Ohio. Our foundation has worked with the Ohio Pediatrics Group to work with doctor's offices to emphasize the need to safely store firearms while they're in the home. Every year we run through hundreds of youth firearm safety training events. We sponsor youth shoots both at the national and international level. It's all about the safety side of it, and that's what the schools are realizing, is that they can't afford enough school resource officers, and to keep those resource officers adequately trained, and no school board should look at their budget and say, do I hire an English teacher or do I keep my kids safe? That's an absurd decision that they should never have to make.
We have to end it there. Joe Eaton, Program Director of FASTER, that's Faculty Administrator Safety Training and Emergency Response Program. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Rebecca Flowers, Co-President of the Central Ohio Branch of the Brady Campaign. Thanks to you as well, Rebecca.
Thanks, Ann.
That's it today. Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.